Our speaker today is Dr. Rick Marks. Where are you? There you are. And for those of you that are just here, Rick is a clinical, are you a clinical psychologist? No. Counselor, whatever. He's going to tell you all about himself. Rick is a good friend. He does our marriage conferences here for the last 6 or 7, 8 years, and you are going to love his presentation today and the rest of the week. Thanks, Rick. Come on up.
Well, good morning. Are you ready for this? I hope so. If you're not, go to sleep. We'll wake you up when I'm done, all right? So whenever I go somewhere for the first time, I like to introduce myself the way that I like to introduce myself. So though not many of you have heard me, and so I just think it's important for you to know who is standing in front of you, at least my background, why I do what I do. Kind of gave a little bit of a background to it last night, but I want to give you a little more in depth. I was born 1961, October 3rd, to Barbara and Richard Marks. I'm the second of four, Kathy, Rick, Don, and Paul. I was born in 1961. My parents divorced after 5 years of marriage. I was raised by my father and my stepmother, the Markses. My father's side of the family are Jewish. My mother's side of the family, my biological mother's side of the family, were Muslim. Figure that one out, right? I was baptized Catholic when I was born. Religious mutt right up here, right? We were raised by my dad and my stepmother. Now, my dad had a generational sin curse that he got from his dad, that he got from his dad. It was an anger issue and a lot of brokenness. It was really a deep father wound. And so my father had these things that he called sessions. I think it was around 10 or 11. He also bought a cow prod and used to shock us. I did not grow up in a really healthy home. Now, my dad taught me some good things. He taught me a good work ethic. He taught me how to laugh. But my dad had a dark side to him that nobody knew about. These things called sessions, I never got one. Because see, the guy standing in front of you, I have a PhD in counseling psychology, I have a master's in marriage family therapy, I have a master's in religious education, all from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. I'm a licensed professional counselor, I'm a clinical member of the AAMFT, I'm an ordained minister, REV, CIA, UFO, EI, EIO. I've got a lot of letters behind my name. But if you notice, the reason I do what I do has nothing to do with my academics. It's because I grew up in a broken home. One of the things I learned in life is don't trust. Don't trust. Writing this was actually interesting for me because it really made me look at myself. So much what you're going to get today is also me. Got it? And what I've had to learn to trust, because I also learned that it wasn't until I was, I guess, my early 30s, I realized I didn't trust God. And I was saved when I was 17. I was raised Unitarian, by the way. Told you, religious mutt. My dad and my stepmom, my father hated Baptists. I got saved by a Baptist church. I come from a long line of Marines. First one to go Navy. I was never good enough. Never could measure up. And so when I left home and joined the Navy, I got stationed in Florida. Where I met this, actually I didn't meet her, I saw her at a Bible study. This girl just walked across the Bible study room, and I looked at her, and I can't tell you why, but I knew then and there I was going to marry her. I even told my senior chief the next day, I said, hey, senior chief. He said, what? I said, I saw the girl I'm going to marry. He said, what's her name? I went, I don't know. He said, well, who is she? I said, I don't know. I just saw her last night. He rolled his eyes. You know, 2.5 years later, he performed my wedding. Her name was Luella. Let me kind of show you my family, if I can get this working here. There's my family. Her name was Luella. Luella, we've been married 32 years. She comes from an alcoholic home with a lot of brokenness and abuse. So two broken people found each other. But Luella found her refuge from all that craziness at First Baptist Church of Jacksonville. But what Luella didn't know, she didn't know, is she became very religious. Her trust wasn't so much in God as much as it was the religious system, the way of thinking. I didn't fit that way of thinking. I wasn't raised in all of that. I always tell people I learned biblical grace in the Unitarian Church. Because in the Unitarian Church, you respected people. When I got saved in a Baptist church, man, they are putting down Catholics, Pentecostals, Presbyterians, everybody. who didn't believe like them. That's why I tell people today, if you ask me what my denomination, I'll tell you, I'm Navy Protestant. You go, what is Navy Protestant? It's real simple. If you're any vets here, where are my vets? It's got to be. All right. Yeah. Now, all us vets know there's only three denominations, Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant. And see, all the products are lumped together. Here's why. We don't care about your denomination. All we want to know is, do you know Jesus is your Lord and Savior? Yes. We're friends. Well, I speak in tongues. So what? I don't. Who cares? Well, I believe in predestination. You don't have a choice. Well, I believe in predestination. You do. I don't care. You see, my brothers and sisters, denomination is just another word for division. That's all it is. It's another word for division. And a house divided will not what? And this is why the church is so broken today. You see, I don't really care. All I care about is, do you know Jesus, your Savior? Yes, we're friends. But we're a part of the same household. Denominations exist because we divide ourselves over issues that have no bearing on eternity. You got it? And so we went to seminary. We married 5 years. God had called me to full-time seminary, full-time Christian service when I was in the still at home. I had just gotten saved. I claim Atlanta, Georgia, is my home. I just gotten saved. And the Lord called me to ministry. I thought that meant I was supposed to be a preacher. I mean, what else are you supposed to do? I didn't know much about the church. And so I set off to go to Tocco Falls Bible College in North Georgia. Got accepted. And the Lord said, no, you're going to the Navy as a chaplain's assistant, an RP. And so I did. Met Luella there. And through my time working in the Navy, I realized that God was not shaping me to pastor a church. He was shaping me to disciple the church. But he was really me to disciple the church. But before I could disciple the church, guess who had me discipled? Me. All right? So we've been married 32 years. We produced 3 children. Had all 3 of my kids at seminary, which only proves you got to do something other than study. All right? All 3 are Texans. My oldest, Trey, 27. He's graduated two bachelor's degrees at the University of North Florida, a degree in psychology and political science. He just finished 2 years in Indonesia in a small village teaching English in a madrasa with the Peace Corps. He just came home about a week and a half ago, and he's studying for his LSAT exam and hopes to be gone by the end of the year, and so do I. My daughter, Madison, graduated 2013, Florida State University, Middle Eastern Studies program. She's the only Rhodes Scholar finalist from the state of Florida that year. She's fluent in Arabic, and she's actually on a plane right now going back to Amman, Jordan. She's got like 103 fever. I'm like, ugh. You know, she wrote us. But she is got a full scholarship at Georgetown University and master's in Arabic studies. So she's playing around the Middle East right now, traveling all over, and she worked for the country Qatar for their foundation. And she helps with the Arab-speaking languages programs in the United States here. And my youngest son, Jesse, just came back from a year in Amman, Jordan in an Arabic language school. He's finishing his last semester at Florida State, same program Madison was in. All my kids had academic honors, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not bragging on them. I'm saying this. When you want to stop a generational sin curse, you can. You can. And my wife and I were set to make sure divorce and brokenness and craziness was not going to pass down through us. We were going to stop it because we cared enough to make sure it didn't happen. That make sense? So much of what I teach isn't my academics. It's because I'm a guy that had to walk it, all right? I'm a guy that had to walk it. Now, so that's us, and I'm proud of them. I'm proud of all 3 of my children. Are we perfect? No. Have we had issues? Yes. Do we love each other? You bet. Are my kids Christians? Yes. Have they been wounded by the church? Yes. Does that make sense? Do you understand that right now in the culture, there's people that don't trust the church. And there's people inside the church that don't trust the church. I mean, trust is foundational. That's why I gave the title of these conversations here. It's the foundation of everything. If you don't trust the company, you're not going to buy their products, are you? You won't do it. Why would you spend your money on something you don't trust, right? And so trust is foundational for everything. And yet, the scripture tells us here, Proverbs 3:5-6, listen to this. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Now, we quote that verse a lot, but anybody here ever have a problem with trust? Am I the only one? If you have an issue with trust, come on, let's be honest. I'm trying to be honest here. Yeah, over half, we struggle with trust. We struggle with it. Because people have done things, or organizations have done things, or people have done or said something that has undermined our ability to what? Trust them. And when you send the message, I don't care that I did that, suck it up, get over it, you understand, you just confirmed in that person's mind not to trust you. Because we're going to spend some time talking about the eight pillars of trust. And when we go through these eight pillars of trust in the next few weeks, next few days, I want you to... It's going to take a long time. I'm starting at my birth and moving you forward 54 years, all right? We really is, I want you to think about the Lord and these eight pillars. Because actually, it took the eight pillars of trust, and I went through, and I found scripture verses to support every stinking one of those pillars. Every one of them. Psalm 84:12 says, Lord Almighty, blessed is the one who trusts in you. And yet, here I was saved, I was a Christian, but I found that I didn't really trust the Lord. And that came through some healing of my father wound issues quite a few years ago. And I realized that unconsciously, I equated God the Father with my earthly father. And there was something in my unconscious that did not believe that what happened to us as kids really mattered to the Lord. So if something happened in my present today, there was something in my unconscious mind that said, yeah, I know you love me, and I know you care about me, and I know that I'm valued, but in the end, it really doesn't matter. You see. And Satan knows this. Dads, listen to me. Whether you like it or not, there is something in children who are going to equate you and who you are to the earthly father. Many years ago, when I was still in graduate school, I wrote a doctoral paper on religious addiction and hyper-religiosity, and I was able to present it at a national conference in Atlanta for the American Counseling Association. But one of the things we did is we looked at the stages of religious development in humans. And you understand the first stage, children learn to trust their environment. If they learn to not trust their environment in the first 2 years of life, then it's very difficult for them to trust something they've never seen. Why are you expecting me to trust something I can't see when the very things that I do see aren't trustworthy? No, I won't do that. You see, blessed is the one who trusts in you. Proverbs 12:22 says it this way, the Lord detests lying lips, but he delights in people who are trustworthy. He delights in people who are trustworthy. Here's what I wrote. Listen to this. My life was one in which I learned not to trust. I didn't trust folks to stay. I learned that people will leave you and forsake you. And what is most sad is I learned not to trust people with my heart. Because people will hurt you and stomp on your heart, right? Even brothers and sisters in the body of Christ. I learned that they will manipulate you in order to take from you to get what they want from you. I learned that people of poor character should not be trusted. I also learned that just because you're a preacher or a Sunday school teacher doesn't mean you are worthy of being trusted. Because what I've learned is your character is more important in whether you are trusted than in how well you preach or teach. I learned that when I worked on our megachurch staff. I learned that people who are consistently late can't be trusted to be consistently late. If you are consistently in a negative way, then I can trust that that's how you are. Because that's who you are, is the way you are. And I can trust that when you're mean, you're mean. I can trust that you're mean. Why? Because you're mean. You see, that one of the pillars of trust is consistency. Problem is consistency, good or bad. I can trust me consistently this way, consistently that way, good or bad. I have learned that trust is built. I've learned that trust is built, and once established, you can undermine it in one action. However, I've also learned that if trust has been firmly established over time, and it's evidence of your character, People are more likely to forgive and reestablish trust in you quickly than if it's a consistent pattern of not being trusted. I've also learned that people who are trustworthy, listen to this, I've also learned that people who are trustworthy are never bothered when their trustworthiness is being questioned. They're never bothered by it. You want to know why? Because they're trustworthy. And when you're trustworthy and someone doesn't trust you, it doesn't bother you. Because at that point, those people go, what do I do? What do I need to do to convince you? Because I am trustworthy. So what could I do? How have I sent a message that I'm not? They're not bothered by it. They're so trustworthy, they'll earn it. I've also learned that where there's a lack of trust, there's a lack of integrity. And where there's a lack of integrity, there's a lack of credibility. Example, many years ago, I do corporate work as well. I teach businesses healthy relationship skills. Many years ago, I was asked to do a breakout session for the Florida Tax Collectors Association. Yes, the Florida Tax Collectors have their own association. And every year, they do an annual conference. So it's all these employees from all the tax, you know, all the counties throughout Florida. And I was asked to do a conference on healthy relationships in the workplace. I have about 200 in the room, and about 30 minutes into my lecture, my cell phone rang. Literally, I picked up my cell phone while it rang, and I went like this. Hello? No, I'm teaching a class right now. Uh-huh. No. No. I told you don't call me. I don't care. Don't call me again. I'll call you. Bye. See you tonight. And I turned around and started teaching. You could just feel this tension in the room. Over here, gentleman kind of said, Dr. Marks. I said, yes. He goes, was that your wife on the phone? And I said, yes. Why? He said, you just talked to her that way? And I said, what way like that? And boy, you could feel the tension in the room, people shifting in their seats. He goes, you're here teaching us about healthy relationships, and you just talked to your wife that way? And I said, you don't like it? Ooh, the murmuring was in the room. People are shifting. And I'm looking around this room, and people are glaring back at me. They're grinning nervously with each other. People shifting. You can feel it. And I went, do you all feel tension in this room? They're like, And I said, I do too. Proctor in the room was sitting right over her. Here, her name is Nancy. I said, Nancy, would you do me a favor? She said, yes. I said, would you please inform this class what I asked you to do for me prior to class? She stood up. She said, you asked me at 30 minutes into your lecture, call your cell phone, let it ring 3 times, and hang up. I said, did you do that? She said, yes. I said, is that your number? Yes, that's my number. And I smiled at the class. I said, well, I guess now you know I've set you up. So I want 2 conversations with you real quickly here. Number one, one action on my part. I turned this room from warm to ice cold tension. I affected everybody in this room and the environment. How often you do that at home or at work, you don't know or you don't care. And then I asked this question. If I had continued teaching, would you have listened to me? And one lady in the middle of the room, she said no. She says, as a matter of fact, I was about to get up and walk out on you. And I said, thank you for that openness and that honesty. Let me ask you a question. I got a PhD, 2 master's degrees, VA. I'm considered a leader in relationship skills and relationship education and leadership in the country. You wouldn't have listened to me? You know what her answer was? No, because you don't have the credibility to teach me. See, no matter what I would say at that point, wouldn't have any trust. Because how can you trust someone teaching if they're not living it themselves? Because where there's trust, there's integrity. With integrity, there's what? Credibility. So I tell parents, you want to take your kids to school or to the church, and yet you treat each other as husbands and wives like trash? When your kids decide they don't want the faith, don't complain. That's why I told my kids when I was on staff at a 28,000-member church many years ago, I said, look, if the way you see you treat me, treat your mama and your dad, your mama and your daddy. Yeah, that go there. The way you see me treat your mom and you is different than how I treat people in public at church. Don't trust my faith, kids. I'm a liar and hypocrite because you know the real me. The real me is not the one in public. The real me is at home. It's at home. So let me ask you something. And give me some feedback real quickly here. When you think of trusting God, what comes to mind? Anybody? Just throw some words. When you think of trusting God, what comes to mind? Anybody? Patience. Strength. Safety. Knowledge. Submission to authority. What's that? Comfort. What's that? Peace. Steadfastness. Everything you give me are related to those eight pillars. But a breakdown in any of those eight pillars, there will be a breakdown in what? Trust. So here's the second question for you. What makes it difficult to trust another person? What's that? Actions? The past experience? The fact that there's people's humanity? What?
Expectations.
Yeah, you're not living up to my expectations, right? And since you're not living up to my expectations, I can't what? Trust you. We'll have a talk conversation around that. Because that will undermine trust as well. You see, there are things that undermine trust. Let me ask you this then. What makes it easier to trust? Consistency, what? History? Yeah, you gotta know a person's history before you trust them. We're gonna have a little short introduction to that, especially for the young people here today. I got something I want you to see. All right. And so for the sake of time, just think about what makes it difficult, what makes it easier. So we're going to talk about trust. We need to define trust. So the blessed place to define something is go to where? Dictionary. So here it is. Dictionary defines trust this way: a firm belief in the reliability, truth, ability, or strength of someone or something. In other words, that relationships have to be built on trust, as a sentence, all right? A firm belief in the reliability, truth, ability, or strength of someone or something. And so that's true as trust as a noun, all right? And so it's a sense of that you are reliable. That there's a firmness in who you are and what you are, all right? Now, the word faith and trust get used interchangeably, don't they? I have trust in that person, I have faith in that person. We use those two words interchangeably, so we need to see if there's any difference in those two words, because we use those as if they're synonyms, but the reality is, on some level they are, but on one level it is not. Example, let's take a look at the definition of faith. Faith, first definition is this: confidence or trust in a person or being. That kind of matches the definition of what? Trust, all right? But listen to this one. Belief that is not based on proof. Belief that is not based on proof. People who are researchers, they develop a thing called a what? A hypothesis, and they have faith that after they do the research, their hypothesis will be proved, right? Because they don't know yet. It's somewhere out there. Or a better way to think of faith, this definition of faith is this. When Jesus says to his disciples, and particularly to Thomas, blessed are those who believe and have not what? Seen. That's us. Because let's be honest, none of us have ever seen Jesus, have we? You've heard stories about him, you've read about him, but we've never what? Seen him. But Jesus is saying, blessed is the person who believes but has never seen. That takes what? Faith. That takes faith. Third definition in the dictionary is belief in God or in the doctrines of a teaching religion. Here's one: a system of religious belief. In other words, the Christian faith or the Jewish faith. And so you'll see that there's a similarity there, but that one definition, belief that is not based in truth, something that you've seen, all right? It's not based on proof, excuse me. So look, I wrote here this: trust and faith have deeper meanings when it comes to using them in relationships. Trust would actually mean that a person places complete confidence and reliance in another person. Faith is more commonly considered a spiritual concept. It is considered as an allegiance, duty, or loyalty to one person or a being. Trust is based on things that I can know. Got it? I know him. I've gotten to see him. I've watched him act over time. And based on what I know of him, that lets me know that I can what? Trust him. All right? And based on my history, with him that says that I can what? Trust him, then I can say that I might trust him in the future, right? Or I might have faith in him around this issue, even though I don't really know. You hear the difference? I write it this way. Trust has a deeper meaning when it comes to using it in relationships. Trust would actually mean that a person places complete confidence in another person. The person believes that the person he or she is trusting will not harm them in any way and will always look out for them. For example, if a person allows a friend to borrow his car, he has trust that that person would not harm his car and would return it in the same condition, all right, that they borrowed it. Another example would include borrowing money, all right? If a person lends his friend money, he trusts that the friend would return the money in due time. Trust is a permanent concept. When a person that has trusted usually trusts them for what? For life, until that person does something that breaks the what? Trust. And if either party breaks trust, sadly, it can take a long time to rebuild it. And sadly, in some relationships, because the trust is so broken, those relationships will only be mended. I found that. I realized some relationships, even in the church, are only going to be mended in heaven. Sadly, but it's a truth. You see, the term trust comes from an Old Norse word, meaning the Old Norse word traus, which means protection and firmness. And I wrote here, faith is more commonly considered as a spiritual concept. It is considered an allegiance, a duty, or loyalty to a person or a being. It can also refer to believing in someone or something, even if no proof exists. For example, I have complete faith in God. This statement suggests that the person believes in God and is loyal in serving the great being. It can also be referred to describe devotion to a person. For example, a girl says, well, I have faith in my boyfriend. This statement states that she is loyal to her boyfriend. Faith has a more positive outlook, so that when an individual placing faith in a person or a being, they're looking for the silver lining. In other words, I have faith they'll come through. Faith is something positive, got it? It usually focuses on something good out there. Trust is based on my experience with you and what I know. Faith is, I don't know, but I'm expecting something good out there, all right? The thing is, trust has both emotional and logical properties to it. Trust has both emotional and logical properties to it. I like to kind of take this and use it. This is a way to parallel it. The word love is grossly misused in the culture today. Let me give an example. I love my wife and I love my children. I love the U.S. military and I love mint chocolate chip ice cream. I love all of them. But do you hear the misuse of that word? You really love mint chocolate chip ice cream? Yes, I do. And yes, if you don't go buy some, feel free. I will take it. Now, you hear the misuse of that word. What if we changed the word love to this word? What difference would it make in how you lived your life? John 3:16 says, for God so what? Love the world. Let's change the word love to this word. What difference would it make in how you lived your life? For God so valued the world that he gave. You see, I value my wife and I do value my children. I do not value the U.S. military near as much. And personally, I do not value mint chocolate chip ice cream, though I do love it. Do you hear the difference? So let me ask you something. If I treated my wife and kids on a regular basis in a way that devalues them, could they not logically argue that I do not love them? Sure they could. So if you say you love someone and you devalue them on a regular basis, don't complain when they question your love, because love doesn't devalue something. Love only places value on things. The things you devalue, that person that you devalue can argue that you don't love them and they will not trust you. Because love doesn't devalue anything. And this is the power of trust. It is both emotional and logical parts to it. Emotionally, it is where you expose your vulnerabilities. Listen, for me to expose my heart to you means I'm taking a risk to what? Trust you, and that you won't harm me or talk ill will of me. And personally, if you did, it wouldn't bother me. My allegiance is not to what you think of me. My allegiance is who Father says I am. Now, will it hurt my ears? Sure, but I won't lose sleep, all right? It is where you expose your vulnerabilities to people, but believing they're not going to take advantage of your openness. Logically, Trust is where you've assessed the probabilities of gain and loss. It calculates expected utility based on a return. If I do this, what might the outcome be? And based on that, I make a decision, right? And if since trust is both logical and emotional, if those two things in harmony, then emotionally, when you're around people you trust, these are the emotions you'll experience. You'll feel companionship. You'll feel friendship. You'll feel love. You'll feel agreement. You'll feel relaxed, and you'll feel comfort. It's what I call the power of us. And you always know when us is in the marriage, it's because us wins, you both win. And you can feel us. And every relationship has an us to it. Come to the marriage conference in October, and you'll get deep into that. So my point to you is basically this. Trust is not something to be taken lightly. We enter into it in all kinds of things. When you sign a contract, the reason you're signing a contract is because you both are making an agreement, right? And if the agreement fails, then we're letting the agreement, which you signed, dictate what happens, does it not? It's because something inside all of us says that people can't be trusted. Right? And so you protect yourselves. You protect yourself. But I trust that you will stand by the agreement. So there are four ways of thinking about trust then. Here they are. Number one, predictability. All right? It is a normal part of the human condition to be constantly forecasting ahead. I wrote here that we build internal models of the world based on our experiences, whatever tell us, and then we use these to guess what will happen next. We're always thinking about what might happen, don't we? Yet the Bible says don't get too far out there, because if you get too far worrying about tomorrow, you lose sight of what? Today, which is what we just kind of heard about from Chad. You know, stop and smell the roses along the way, right? Be okay with be here, live here. But some people, when you focus too far out there, you get anxious, you feel insecure, you start to worry, and your worries will rob you of the present. It's the way it works. So trust means being able to predict what other people will do and what situation that'll occur. If we can surround ourselves with people we trust, then we actually create a safer environment for ourselves, right? So if I can put myself around people that I trust, then I feel what? Safer. If you put yourself in an environment that is not trusting, it's happening around the country right now, going to a combat zone, right? And if you're in a place that you don't know you can trust, then the brain becomes hyper-elevated neurochemically at an anxious rate because you're having to look around all the time to survive. So it's about predictability. It's also about value exchange, value exchange. One of the things I learned a long time ago when I managed psych hospitals is Thorazine is Thorazine is Thorazine. Haldol is Haldol is Haldol. Prozac is Prozac is Prozac. Got it? No, you can go to any hospital and get the medication. So what's going to make our hospital more trustworthy than somebody else's hospital? And ultimately, it's going to be customer service, how you got treated. Because you can go to a really nice facility and be treated like dirt, right? If you get treated like dirt, you don't want to go there because you don't trust those people, right? And so it's about value exchange as well, all right? If I have sheep, if I've got a bunch of sheep and you've got a bunch of cows, well, I can get milk from you and you can get wool from me. We got a good value exchange, don't we? We can trust each other, right? And so the idea here is this. Trust means making an exchange with someone when you do not have full knowledge about them, their intent, and the things they're offering you. Now, young people, be aware of this right here. What we're really saying is, you never trust more than you know. This is the work of Dr. John Van Epp. He calls this the relationship attachment model. There are five ways that humans bond. They bond through knowledge, they bond through trust, they bond through alliance, they bond through commitment, and they bond through touch. Each of those by themselves will bond you. Your name is?
Bill.
So I don't know Bill. But let's say I spend some time today sitting and getting to know Bill. This is a meter. It goes from, let's say, 0 to 10. I don't know Bill. Now, I just learned his name, so my meter went to, like, a half, right? So Bill and I start to get to know each other, right? And as we start to get to know each other, we're actually building a relationship. We're bonding. If I don't know much about him, but I'm forced to trust him somehow, got it? Then we're going to bond. I mean, I know the guy or trust him, but my foot's, you know, underneath a car that turned over. I have to know where what? Rely on him to survive. Because I have to rely on him to survive. Now, I've never met the guy, don't know him, but now I'm relying on him. The fact that I have to rely on him means we're on a what? We're building a relationship, all right? When you commit to someone and you start touching. Touching at the bottom might be a pat, up there it'd be intercourse, all right? Now, though they each bond you separately, they also work on a hierarchy. The more I get to know you, it allows me to realize that I can what? Trust you. And I never trust more than I know. But see, here's the problem. This is the way that it actually works, all right? Right there. This is how it works. The more I know, the more I can trust. The more I trust means I can rely on you. This is about confidence in you. Why am I confident? Because I've learned something about you over time. And the more I've learned about you over time, this says I can trust you. Now, because this is about risk-taking, I can depend on you. I can rely on you, which allows me to increase commitment and in relationships, allowed me that to be expressed in touch. But here's what the culture is doing. The culture's reversed it. Go ahead and have physical relations with someone. You can commit to them, but you know you can't trust or rely on them. Who's the jerk? We're giving away the most intimate form of human expression to people you know you can't trust, or to someone you don't know or could trust, but you give it away anyways. That's what the culture has done. And this one girl came to me. She moved in with her boyfriend. 3 months. Only met him in a bar. 3 months. They started together within a week. 3 months later, she's in my office crying. He took all her money from the ATM. She gave him the PIN number when he moved in. You gave him your PIN number? Well, yeah, we moved in there. But you only knew him for a week. Well, I know, but he just seemed so... Fill in the blank. You're a jerk, that woman. You never trust more than you. No. So what do you want to know about a person before you start trusting them? Here's some things, particularly young people. You get to know a person's conscience. It takes time to know that. People can lie and wear masks to you for quite a while, but eventually the conscience is going to come through. You got to know their conscience. Is it too hard? Is it too rigid? You got to know how they handle how they communicate and how their family communicated. You got to know how they handle anger. And when you start to see a pattern of behavior a certain way, that probably tells you who they are. Don't ever listen to what people say. Don't ever listen to what people say. Watch what they do. Got it? I never listen to what people tell me. The questions I ask get at people's patterns. And once I know your pattern, I can tell you who you are. I had a guy in my office here 3 weeks ago. Marriage is failing. He's moved out. He's an adulterer. And about 15 minutes into the session, I made a comment to him about who he was. He goes, "So you're thinking you know who I am?" It was a challenge. So I said, "Yeah, I do." "So you know who I am after what, 50 minutes? I said, "Yep." "Isn't that kind of arrogant?" I go, "No, actually, it's brilliant." He goes, "What?" I go, "It's called profiling. That's what the FBI does. So the FBI watches for patterns, and once they establish a pattern, they can tell you who to look for. You already have the pattern of this kind of person. That's who you are." And his wife is sitting there shaking her head the whole time. And I wasn't even looking at her. It's not hard to figure out who people are. Understand their patterns. You can tell who a person is. Here's why. I can fake being something in a moment. Got it? But who I am on the inside will always show up. Always show up in a what? Because a pattern is the evidence of who you are on the inside. In the FBI knows that. That's profiling. Got it? So remember, never trust more than you what? No. All right. Next one. Let me pass it. The next of those. I got to jump on ahead here. Looking at the time. Delayed reciprocity. What this really means is basically this: trust means giving something now with an expectation that it'll be repaid. In other words, if I give you $20 today, because I loan it to you, I'm going to trust you're going to what? You're going to pay it back. It's another level of trust. And lastly is exposed vulnerabilities. Trust means enabling other people to take advantage of your vulnerabilities. When I get up here, and I you never heard me speak, some of you have, but I'm very open about who I am and what I've done and my failures and what I've learned and gleaned from Father. I never tell about other people. I just carry my own journey, especially my marriage work. All right? But I trust that I do that, one, because Father said, you need to model for them who I am. Yes, sir. But secondly, and more importantly, if I'm asking you to do the same thing in your own relationships, how dare me if I don't live it out before you? That would make me untrustworthy on one level. Got it? I gain my trust by being the very thing that I teach. So then, we're going to look at the 8 pillars this week. What are the 8 pillars? Here they are. These are the 8 pillars of trust. Clarity. Trust comes when you are clear about things. People who are consistently vague and evasive lose trust. Compassion. The most often repeated phrase used about Jesus in the New Testament is that he was moved with compassion. We're going to look at that and how that builds trust. Character. Who you are and who you are not will build character. Competency. Competency. Now, I've got a PhD in counseling and that kind of stuff. I'm known at the national level. I'm an author. I wrote a book, Relations for Life, and working on another one. But if you could ask the question, hey, is Rick competent in helping people? The answer would be what? Yes. All right. Is Rick competent in helping eating disorders? No. I'll take you to McDonald's and get you a burger. We'll talk about it, right? I don't have a competency there. So you probably shouldn't trust me in it. Or let's say your name is Matt. Matt comes to me. Hey, Rick, I know you got a PhD. I got a molar needs to be extracted. Okay. You really think he's going to trust me to take his tooth out? No. Because you trust people who are what? Competent. And here's the key. Competency starts with humility. Competency begins with humility. Because you have to realize you're not competent in some areas. In order for you to realize that, you've got to move to what? Humility. Commitment. Sadly, this culture doesn't know commitment. It sees no value in commitment. Because this culture, particularly millennials today, have not experienced commitment. This generation today does not value marriage as a group. And the reason is they have seen no good examples of marriage. What they have seen is moms and dads don't value commitment. They value themselves. And so companies don't. So commitment is crucial to trust. Connection, that's about building relationships. There's got to be a connection there. Contribution, this is not about tithing. This is people who are trustworthy, people who give. People who constantly take, are not people to be trusted, are they? Because people who are trusted give. And lastly, consistency. And I'm going to argue that though consistency is the bottom, it's also the foundation for all of those. Because you're going to have to be consistent in all of those pillars. And I said, we're going to take two of these each week. All right? Two of these each day. We'll look at clarity and compassion. I don't know why I keep saying each week. Maybe it's one of my other personalities inside. I forgot to tell you about that. I have 12. All right? So let me say this to you. A lack of trust will cost you. We're going to look at these somewhat in depth. It costs business customers and money. It'll cost you your kids. Folks, I'm being honest with you. I trusted my parents to provide for us. My dad was a great provider. I'll share it with you. I don't usually share this much publicly. My dad owned a helicopter. He owned planes. He bought his Rolls before he died 32 years ago. We lived in a small little town outside of Atlanta, a little town called Powder Springs, 27 acres. He had money, but I would never trust my father with my heart, ever. Even to the day he died, he had not earned it. I would never trust my stepmother with my heart. She had not earned it either. Well, I trusted him for this, but I knew not to trust him over here because he proved himself not to be trustworthy, and so did my stepmother. You see, trust will cost you. It costs businesses money. It costs businesses customers. Trust is a necessity for healthy relationships, economic activity, and the health of society. Can we argue that there's a lack of trust in government today? Isn't there? There's a lack of trust in the home. There's a lack of trust from the culture to the church. And look at the cost. Look at the cost. Arabs don't trust Jews, and Jews don't trust Arabs. And look at the cost. Look at the cost, because a lack of trust will cost you. You see, the biggest deception is the person who appears to be a person of trust and actually is not. Is not. I have a slide here. I call this the pain and potential of trust. As trust increases, this will increase. your connection to those people increase. And as connections increase, people tend to become vulnerable. As they tend to become vulnerable, you start to feel safe around that person. So you start to feel secure around that person. And if you feel secure around people, you develop intimacy with that person. This is not about physical attraction. This is about openness, friendship. This is about a trust inside that allows me to share my heart with you. And when you're in those kind of people's presence, it's like me around Paul and Jerry. I love those two. And they're two of the safest people for me. And when I'm with them, I feel safe. I told my wife, safest place I know is their house. Next to mine. With Llewellyn in it. And I don't say that because they're here. It's because it's true. And as peace develops, us develops. Moms and dads, husbands and wives. This is the path God wants for your marriage. But when you do things that undermine trust, here's the path you'll take. Because as trust becomes undermined, there's pain and anger. And that pain and anger is there because you keep doing what you're doing, then I start to fear you might do it again. And when I start to fear you might do it again, I start to wall myself off emotionally with you. And as the wall grows over time, I distance myself from you. Because emotional walls put distance between people. And as you start to distance, you become guarded. I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to share with you. I'm not going to let you know what's going on in my life. Why would I tell you that? And then that creates distress because the more you're there, your brain will eventually, over long term, turn to anxiety. It turns to depression. Then you go see a therapist who medicates your brain. And then you want justice. I want you to hurt just like I do, buddy. You've done this to me, and I'll trust you. I'm going to pay you back. Now I want justice. And all of that moves you into aloneness, Genesis 2:18. It is not good for man to be what? That aloneness has nothing to do with married. Because married people, let's be honest, you can be married and very much alone. And trust undermines every bit of it. It's happening in society. It's happening in cities. It's happening in the church. And sadly, it's happening in families all across the country. And most sad, it's rampant in the body of Christ. It really is. I mean, if you think about it, it goes right back to Genesis 2, Genesis chapter 3. Did God really say the day you eat it, right, you're going to die? In that moment, they got them to question what God said and not to what? Trust it. It was an undermining of trust. It was an undermining of trust. So what are some barriers to help you overcome trust? Here's some I've written down if you're taking notes. Here's some barriers to help you overcome trust. You're going to have to overcome fear. God did not give a spirit of fear, but power, love, and a sound mind. You have to overcome your negative experiences from the past just as much as I did. You're going to have to overcome the need to instantly gratify yourself. It's okay to have needs. We're needy. The soul is needy. God made us that way. You have to learn patience and self-control. You have to learn to quit focusing on the negative and see the positive. You're going to have to learn to overcome your fears of an us. Some people are afraid of that kind of a relationship. They don't believe they're good enough. You're going to have to overcome those actions that you do that put the interests of one person over another. My son said to me once, when he was like 13 or 14, he was mad at me. He goes, "You love mommy more than me." And I said, "You're right. Get used to it." And the reason I said that is, do you know what the first highest divorce hurdle now, the first divorce hurdle in America is the first 5 years of marriage. That is when people most likely to divorce. The second divorce hurdle is the empty nest. Here's why. Parents, marriage was never, sorry kids, you may want to hear this, but it's still true. Marriage was never meant to be child-centric, ever. But when you make when you put the marriage and put children in between it, then your bond is no longer between you two. You attach to your children. All your bonds come through the kids. And when your kids leave one day, guess what? Your bond left as well. And that's the second highest divorce rate right there. Never, ever, ever put them in between us. Now, does that mean you don't love your children? No. Do you understand that child-centric marriages started in the 1950s? It did. It actually started in the 1950s, and businesses drove it. Capitalism drove it. They realized that teenagers were an economic powerhouse to market to because they knew the parents would give them money to go spend. If you want to learn more about it, go get the book, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. We have fewer and fewer healthy, mature adults in America. We have mostly today our emotional children raising children. And this is why you see the craziness in America today. Because what you see taking today, mature adults don't act that way. Children hit. Children lash out. Adolescents want to fight. Mature adults find ways to negotiate. And lastly, you're going to have to overcome your issues with fidelity if that's an issue that you deal with. So in closing, I would like to read a quote from David Horsager, who wrote the book, The Trust Edge. I met David this year, as a matter of fact. He came to my marriage retreat at Big Sandy Camp, the one I do here. Big Sandy had me come up. And he said, man, Rick, what you teach is what I teach, just in a different way. He wrote a book called The Trust Edge, and it was the 8 pillars. He gave me his book. He said, I want you to learn this. I want you to go teach this with me. I'm like, okay. So I'm reading his book. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. This guy has broken down trust to a science. He was a graduate of Bethel in Minneapolis. And he teaches all over the world, Fortune 500 companies, military academies. And I said, David, everything you're teaching applies to the family. He says, I know. That's why I want to work with you. I want to come up with another book that takes these to the family. I said, I'm way ahead of you. I've already started it. I'm teaching it at Fort Wilderness. He goes, well, give me some credit. I said, I will. He said, I don't want you to sue me. But listen to this quote. Trust is the natural result of thousands of tiny actions, words, thoughts, and intentions. I'm going to read that again. Trust is the natural result of thousands of tiny actions, words, thoughts, and intentions. It does not happen by accident, nor does it happen all at once. Gaining trust is work. Knowing that you need it isn't enough. You and I have to do the little things on a daily basis to earn it. So may it be that this week we begin our journey into trust. Is that okay? Thoughts or comments? Has this been helpful? Cool. Now, when we close, I'm going to teach you something that we do in our marriage work. I raise my kids on the skill you're about to learn. So those of you who have older kids, humor your parents and do it for me, all right? But I promise you, if you take the risk to do this, you'll find great benefit in it. I'm going to teach you a skill, and I'm going to ask, not demand, I'm going to ask that you do this every week here as a family while you're together here. It is what we call a daily temperature reading. Each family will get a daily temperature reading card when you leave, okay? You'll get this card. This is what's called a confiding exercise. The daily temperature reading is a confiding exercise. Confiding is the key to bonding. When people don't like each other or trust each other, they quit confiding in each other. But we have to confide because trust builds when we confide, because intimacy builds when you learn to confide. And by the way, wherever you confide, you will bond. The internet and chat rooms have proven that like crazy. People are bonding in places they should be bonding, though. Got it? And so what we're going to do is you do this as a family. I did this with my kids growing up. I still do this with my wife today. The first thing we want you to do is we want you to confide in each other in appreciation, something you preach about somebody in the house, all right? My daughter, I'm not saying it was always easy. I mean, we go around the table. All right, you know, Trey, what do you appreciate? He'd say something. Madison, my driven one, what do you appreciate? Nothing. No, come on, Madison, you can appreciate something. Nope, nothing. Come on, Madison, you appreciate one thing. I appreciate the floor mats. Great, okay, next. Jesse. Now, she's 25, and guess what she shares? Appreciations. We need to appreciate. And those in your family need to know that they're appreciated. I remember a long time ago, before I started learning all this for myself, I said, well, I know everything that I do that you don't appreciate. Is there anything I do appreciate? She said, that I do you? She goes, yes. I go, I need to hear it. Here's why. It's neurochemical. Proverbs 16:24 says it this way, pleasant words are pleasing to the body. Well, how is that true? It's called dopamine. Whenever you share an appreciation with someone, the moment their brain hears that appreciation, their brain releases a neurochemical called what? Remember dopamine, because when it gets released, it's a shot of pleasure. You get dopamine when you get mint chocolate chip ice cream. That's why I keep going back to it. Whenever you eat, you get dopamine. Dopamine is released around pleasurable things, sinful or not sinful. So guard your heart, because dopamine is released around pleasurable things, even if it's sinful. That's why the Bible says there's pleasure in sin for a season. Because once the dopamine wears off, the source of your pleasure is really the source of your what? Pain. All right? Next is new information. New information is anything you want to share that those people don't know. When couples and people get in conflict, they quit sharing with each other. Puzzles are something you're puzzled about. Like, I'm puzzled as to where Osama bin Laden's body is. It's just a puzzle for me. I'm puzzled as to whether you respect me, Luella. I'm puzzled as to whether you value me, Dad. I'm puzzled, Mom, as to whether you appreciate me. Those are puzzles. We all have them. We either share them in negative ways or we hold them in. We want you to confide them out in a respectful way. Next is a complaint with a quest for change. It's in the format of I notice and I prefer. Rather than, why do you always leave? You know, you come home on your trip, Rick, and you just throw your luggage right there. That's a complaint. It doesn't get you anywhere. Complaint with a quest for change sounds like this. I have a complaint with a quest for change. Yes, what is it? I notice when you come home on your trips, you put your luggage there. What I prefer is you get your stuff out and put those things in the closet. More respectful and get you to the same place. I told you, I raised my kids on this. A while back, my youngest son came to me. He was still at FSU before he left he's been away in Jordan for a year, just came back. But before he left for Jordan, he said that, and I said, yeah, what is it? He said, I notice that you like to give your input to me about your thoughts about me and my girlfriend on the phone when I'm with her. She can hear you. I prefer you keep those conversations off the phone and to me and you in person, because I do want to hear them, Dad. I went, oops, will you forgive me? He said yes, and we hugged and kissed, and he left the room, and I started gritting. Luella, who saw this exchange, goes, what are you gritting about? I went, he used the skills. He could have come in here like most people who are immature. Hey, Dad, you know I'm sick. Who do you think you are? Tell me. Childish. He had the ability to use the skill to convey something that bothered him in a mature way, and when he said I had a complaint with a question for change, that means I just had to listen and care. Isn't that cool? I'm proud. Share an apology, a prayer request, and then we ask you to pray for each other, prayer requests, and then wishes, hopes, and dreams. So, I don't know if you got my text, but did you? Would you guys come up and model it for us?